Al-Anon was started in the Baton Rouge area quite a long time ago by Pat O'Brien's wife, Dora. But she just ran it out of her kitchen, sort of. And by the time I came in to Al-Anon, the meeting was on 5th Street. What we did, you have to understand, is they were tearing down downtown. So as the house was sold to whatever company intended tearing it down, somebody would go and beg for the use of it until they actually tore it down. So every time they tore down a house, we had to move. But our meetings on 5th Street were really kind of nice, and a good meeting was 8 people. And mostly it was less than 8 people. But there was one lady there named Eleanor, and she was just a marvelous person, and she kept everything going on a nice even keel. Then we had to leave 5th Street and we moved to 8th Street. And at that point, our numbers began to increase. Now, 8th Street was not an Al-Anon's dream. First of all, you had to, if you got there late, you had to climb over all the AAs to get into the Al-Anon room. Then when you got in the room, you had to climb over the people there to find a place to sit. And it had the ugliest purple wallpaper I've ever seen in my life. And I always said that anybody who came there twice really needed Al-Anon. Well, we didn't have any literature. In fact, I can remember that for a long time, I thought the 12 steps was some sort of a secret that when they thought I was worthy, they were going to tell me what they were. But we'd take up a collection at each meeting, and everybody put in a dime or a quarter. And one day, somebody put in a dollar. And then after that, people put in a dollar. And then we bought literature. And we started what I believe is still a tradition in this group, and that is we gave away literature to anybody who came to the meetings. And it started from our $1 bill, so you never know what money will do for you. Then, fortunately, we got thrown out at 8th Street, so we moved to North Boulevard. And we had a member who deserves a great deal of credit for everything that we have in Al-Anon now, because at that time, and it still does, the phone at LSU operated, and I had worked there, and she had worked there, and we both agreed that it simply didn't serve the purposes of people who had alcohol problems. So she decided that we needed a phone, and since we had nothing really except the little dollar that we got, she put it in her own name and paid it out of her family. That was our surety that the phone company would get their bill. And at that point, we really began to increase. You know, we were kind of short on alcoholics then. Not that we didn't have them around, but there were no treatment centers here, and we just didn't get a lot of them, so we didn't get a lot of Al-Anons. But once they started having treatment centers, then the business flourished. So we decided at that point that we should start another meeting, and Daisy and I and a couple of others went out and started one at LSU, so that was meeting number 2. And then from there on, I don't think we can count them at this point. But I was starting the phone, I think, was one of the best things that we did. And I would go down. That was quite the building was covered by vines, you see. And it was sort of the kind of place that would attract tramps. So whenever I went down to do my duty on the phone, I always carried a gun. The phone man came in one day and he said, "Can you shoot?" I said, "Just get a little closer and I'll show you." So then from there, the AA people started Club 12, and we had one room in Club 12, and we had the phone in there. And That was really nice. I liked it best of any setup we had because it gave us an opportunity to get to know a lot of the AA members quite well. And if I hadn't known Fletch, for instance, my life would not just have been as full as it could be. He was a wonderful, crotchety old fellow. And when I first met him, I thought, stay away from me. But after I got to know him, I began to love him. And when they had a big party for Fletch, the young people he had worked with in Houston came over here in caravans. That tells you the kind of man he was, just because he was crotchety. One AA I remember came in one day and he said to Fletch, "You think I'm stupid?" Fletch said, "I know you're stupid. Now let's go on to the next step." But anyway, from there we got our own office and all this other stuff, but that's how our mind. How about that?
That's very good, girl. Very good. By the way, welcome in the back. Glad you can make it. Now it's time for our speaker. Bo T from Hueytown, Alabama. Bo, by the way, I didn't introduce his wife, Shirley. Shirley, stand up. My God, we got to recognize you. And they're quite a AA Al-Anon family. Their daughter is also just graduated from Elatine, and she's been a speaker in Elatine, so now she's Al-Anon, so it looks like she'll be a speaker in Al-Anon also. We'll just sit back and listen to Bo. Let him share with us and see where we can identify with it. And I've heard his tape, and he's an excellent speaker. Let's welcome Bo T.
Hi, I'm an Al-Anon from Hueytown, Alabama, and my name is Bo Templin.
Hi, Bo.
Hi. First I want to thank Jim and thank these folks that invited Charlie and I to come down here this weekend. It's a treat for us to get to go and to see old friends, see folks that we've met before, and look forward to running into them, because we know they're going to be there. We know they're good Al-Anons, and they're going to be there. And then to meet new friends and know that we're going to go away from here richer and plan on seeing you folks again somewhere down the road as we trudge this happy path. It really is a treat for us to be here. Wish we could have brought Sissy with us. She did just last week graduate from Alateen to Al-Anon because she had her 20th birthday. But she's real busy right now. She's vice president of Monta Valley University. Now, that's her story. She's in her second year there and doing real well in school. But she did send her love. She wishes she could be here. It's a crazy feeling right now. Usually when I get a chance to share, I make that first talk, and anybody that's ever shared knows what I'm talking about. There's three talks you make. You make the one before you get up here, and then you make the one while you're up here, and then the third one, of course, is where you think about all the things that you should have said. And it's been crazy this morning. I haven't been able to get a train of thought going, and maybe that's best, because when it happens that way, I can just turn it over to God, and maybe Bo can just be an instrument today, and I hope that's what happens. When I introduced myself to you, I told you that I was an Al-Anon, and Jim so graciously introduced Shirley. Being Shirley's spouse does not make me an Al-Anon. Being Shirley's spouse qualifies me for Al-Anon. And I thought when I first got here that being married to her made me an Al-Anon, and I had to find out different. And if you're new here today, I would like to share that with you, because there's a lot of things that go into this big old boy being an Al-Anon. Things like going to a lot of meetings. And I had to learn, too, going to meetings at my home group. Because you see, it's there that they know me. And that they won't allow me to blow smoke. And they'll confront me. Having a sponsor is a big part of me being an Al-Anon. Carrying the message is a big part. I'm fortunate enough to have a sponsor who's very active in service work, and so she made it part of my recovery that I become active in service work. And if you haven't tried it, I suggest to you that you do try it. It's a very, very rewarding segment of recovery. And the biggest thing, of course, that makes me an Al-Anon is, to the best of my ability on a daily basis, working 12 simple steps in my life. 12 simple steps that I insist on complicating because I am a complicated person. And I found out today that as long as I can keep Bo out of the direction of that, if I can keep Bo fired and God hired, then we do okay. We do all right. I certainly don't want to scare you if you're new, and I'm telling you these things about Al-Anon, because I want you to know that your answer is here. This is where it is. God, how long we looked for the answer out there. And the answer is not out there, the answer is here. Right here in meetings just like this, and in smaller meetings, in individual one-on-ones, and in sharing this great way of life. And I can promise you this, that every effort that I've ever put into this program has been paid back to this old boy tenfold. It's not easy, but it's darn sure worth it. And it's neat that we can be here today and talk about not only the heritage of Al-Anon in Baton Rouge, but the heritage of Al-Anon in each one of our individual lives. And we can take a moment and we can look back and we can see how it was and what happened and how much better it is today. My simple mind is not capable of comprehending the power of these 12 steps and this way of life. I just don't know. I can't even fathom the good things that can come out of this way of life. It's infinitely more powerful than I ever dreamed. And if you're new and you're around it, I challenge you to get in it. To get in it. Because you'll find out as I share my story with you that for a period of time I was around it and I couldn't make it work. And I had to get in it. You know, before I start telling you a little bit about me, there's one more thing that I want to say. Because I know there's some AAs in this room. And if you're an AA in this room, I have a message for you. And it's meant for you individually, and I wish that you would carry it back to your groups. And tell them that there's a big old boy from Hueytown, Alabama that said thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being there and saving my wife's life. Thank you for having 12 steps for her that saved her life and gave her back to me. And then second, thank you for loving us family members enough to allow us to use your 12 steps. Because that's where we came from. We came from your 12 steps. and I say thank you. It's important that I start to share with you very early in my life. And I'll start it with this simple statement. I was born at a very early age. And that's where it all started. That's where I began to be prepared for my introduction to Al-Anon and this 12-step way of life. Because you see, I was born into that good breeding ground for AAs and Al-Anons and Alateens. I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. I don't know that we were that spiritual, but we were certainly very religious. I was carried to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, and on Wednesday nights. And this went on up through my mid-teens. I had no choice. I was required to go. What's important about this area of my life, this time of my life, is that it was there in that Southern Baptist church in those Sunday school rooms that I formed a conception of God that I was to bring into adulthood with me that was going to cause me some problems. Because you see, what I brought from that Southern Baptist church was that God was a judging God and that God was a punishing God. And that wherever God sits up there, there was a scoreboard and it had my name on it. And if I did something good, there was a check mark. And if I did something bad, there was a big X put up there. And anytime the X went up, there was some sort of penalty to be paid. And then when my judgment day came, we would compare the checks with the X's to see where old Bo was going to spend eternity. Now, I know today, in doing my inventory and in looking back over my life, I know that in that Southern Baptist church that I was taught that God is loving and that God is forgiving. I know that. But you see, I did not choose to bring that with me as I came into adulthood. I brought with me that conception that I formed about the judgment and the penalties. And when Shirley and I met, and we dated for 5 years before we married. Boy, more powerful than I thought. We dated for 5 years. She came from an alcoholic home. I came from a divorced, dysfunctional home. And one of the vows that we made when we decided to get married was that, good or bad, we were married and we were going to stay married. And we've held true to that, and if she'll behave herself the rest of this month, the 30th day of this month, we'll celebrate number 25. I know what you're thinking, and I agree. She got me young, didn't she? There was no drinking. I had been very active in sports in high school, and at that time, jocks didn't drink. Shirley came from that alcoholic home and had a hatred for it. And we married, and about 3.5 years after we were married, we had Mike, beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed son. A year and a half later, we had Sissy. And as Shirley says, at that time, that was all the choice that there was, a boy and a girl. That was all the variety, so we decided to stop. We had our family in place. We had two kids. We had two cars. We had a house. Everything we had was mortgaged to the hilt, and we had the great American dream going on. Our purpose in life was to work harder and make more money so we could buy better things and go deeper in debt so we would have to get a better job to make more money. Everything that we were doing in our lives at that time was centered around the dollar, the great American dream. And then Shirley got involved in a social sorority, and it was at one of these social sorority dances one Saturday night that I mixed her a drink and gave it to her. I mixed my alcoholic, the first drink of alcohol that she'd ever had in her life, and handed it to her. And some years later, when her disease began to progress and things began to get bad in our house, she was real quick to point her finger at me. And not knowing anything about the disease of alcoholism and not understanding what was going on, I was real quick to accept that blame and accept that guilt. And that was a load of guilt that was to get real, real heavy, almost unbearable, before I got to you people and you people could tell me that I did not cause it and I could not control it and that I certainly couldn't cure it. I thought that I was the martyr. Because you see, I was the head of the household. I was the one that was keeping the ship afloat. I did not realize the changes that were coming about in me as a result of the disease of alcoholism. I'll share with you a couple of things that happened. And of course, I found these out in doing my inventory. I did not realize it when it was going on. One of the things that happens, I became one of the most proficient liars in Hueytown. One of the most proficient liars there. And I was not raised to be a liar. But you see, I justified it and I rationalized it because it had to be done. It had to be done. There was a lady down at Alabama Power Company that I was on a first name basis with. And of course, you that have been involved in this disease know that financial problems just seem to come along with it, don't they? And one of the bills that just could not get paid around our house was the power bill. And this lady would call me about every other month. And she'd say, "Bo, I didn't get your check." You notice she'd call me Bo? And I'd never seen this lady. "Bo, I didn't get your check." And I would, boy, it would click in. And I would tell her, "Oh, yeah, I know. Shirley finally confessed to me last night that she had not paid the power bill. And I stopped on the way to work this morning and dropped you a check in the mail." And that was a lie. Because, you see, I hadn't done it. I didn't know the bill hadn't been paid. And if I had dropped a check in the mail, it would have bounced. Because there wasn't any funds. But this gave me 24 hours because she would wait until the mail came the next morning. And this gave me 24 hours to run to brother or run to daddy or mother or uncle or somebody and get the money and be there at 8 o'clock the next morning. My rationalization was, I can't have the power turned off. The kids can't study. We can't cook supper. If it's hot, we've got to have the air conditioning. You can't stay in the house. We just couldn't function without it. And I had to admit one day that that was not really it. Because you see, there was two or three times that I couldn't borrow the money. And we did what everybody else did that was living the great American dream. We pulled out that plastic card, that money that you don't have, and we went down to the motel and we rented a room and charged it until we could get the money to get the power back on. And of course told the kids we were taking them down where they could swim, let them have a few days R&R. But you see, I had to admit to myself one day that the real reason that I did this was because if they came out there and turned the power off, I hope none of you had to experience this, they put a little red tag on your door. You know, it's about 12 inches long. If you've ever had one put on your door, that sucker looks 3 foot long. And if they put that red tag on the door, then if you lived up the street from me, you knew what was happening. And I couldn't allow you to know what was going on. Because you see, we had the curtains pulled. We didn't allow you to see in. We didn't let you know. If you'd have run into me at work and you'd asked me, "Bo, how are things going?" I'd have given you that patented smile and said, "Fine, fine." Yet we were a basket case. One of the things that that the kids and I did every night when Shirley would go in and slither in between the sheets and pass out. And see, this was her pattern. She was a kitchen drinker. She got off at 4 o'clock. She was home at 4:30, and at 4:31, she had a drink in her hand. At about 8:30 or 9 o'clock, she would go in, slither in between the sheets, and pass out. Now, she did that. It didn't matter if the preacher was there, if you were there, if nobody was there, if we were in the middle of supper. It didn't matter. When her time came, she just disappeared. And the kids and I gathered every night after she had slithered into bed, and we went on our witch hunt. And this is when we went into the kitchen and we dug the bottles out. And we poured the booze out and we threw the bottles away. And this happened every night. Every night. Got an aunt, been around this program quite a while. At that time, she had 20 years sobriety. This past Valentine, she picked up a 27-year chip. And she knew what was going on. And she was doing what good AAs do. She was just watching and waiting. Watching and waiting. And she called me at work one day and she said, "Bo, how are things going out y'all's place?" And I gave her that fine and she gave me that comeback that said, "Oh no, it's not either. Now how are you handling it?" And I was real proud of it. And I said, "Katie, let me tell you what we're doing, Aunt Katie." And I told her about how we went and we found the booze and we poured it out, and she just laughed. She said, "I didn't know you were that well off financially." And I didn't even understand her. I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, what does Shirley do the next day coming home from work?" And I said, "Well, she stops and buys more." And it hit me as I said it. I said, "Why don't you let her drink what she already has?" But you know, as sick as I was and as involved as I was in this thing, I could not stop it. I never stopped those witch hunts. And it was 2 years later from the time of this conversation that Shirley went into treatment. But I did change it, and I changed it in this respect. The kids and I still went on the witch hunts, and we still found it, and I still poured it out. But instead of throwing the bottle away, I set the bottles up on the drain board of the sink. See, I was sending messages to Shirley, and the message to Shirley was, "Yeah, see, dummy, we found it, and we poured it out." Okay? That tells you where the communication was in our relationship. We could talk about what happened as a result of it. And we could argue about the plans that had to be changed because of it. But we couldn't talk about it. We couldn't talk about it. We didn't know what it was. And we could talk about everything else, but we couldn't talk about it. And see, my message to Shirley was, "See, we found it and we poured it out." It was 2 years later in treatment that we were discussing this during family week, and Shirley's jaw dropped open. And she said, "My God, for 2 years, every morning I got up and went to the kitchen and said, 'Oh no, you drank it all again.'" Mixed messages. Mixed messages. One of the other things that I must share with you in being honest in my story is that one of the ways that I put up with Shirley's drinking was that I drank too. I drank with her. I drank without her. And I've already told you that she would get home at 4:30, and at 4:31 she had a drink in her hand. And I didn't get off until 5, so about 4:45 I would call. And I could smell it over the telephone. See some folks nodding your head. I'm not the only one that could. And if she had started drinking, which usually was the case, my answer to that was I would stop by the water hole, the local lounge, with the guys from work. And I would have a few drinks, too. And the tragedy of that was those two kids. Those two kids that at this time in their life were in the area of 10, 11, 12, and 13 years old, along in that area of their life. And they were getting nothing. Absolutely nothing. A daughter that was having to go across the street to talk to a neighbor about girl things. And a son whose answer to it was when he got home from work, he jumped on his motorcycle and he left. And he didn't come back until his curfew. He ran from it. He couldn't stand to be around it. And Mama was drinking in the kitchen and Daddy was down the street drinking. And God, if I could tell you how many times I've sat there in that lounge with those guys after work and I've looked at that drink sitting in front of me watching the ice melt and saying, Bo, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? You don't want the drink. You're not having fun. Why are you here? And I was there because I couldn't go home. I couldn't go home because I couldn't face a problem that I couldn't fix, that I couldn't handle. Because you see, I didn't have time in my life to be wrong. And I didn't have time in my life to not face things that I couldn't fix. My answer was just like Mike's, and I didn't realize it. My answer was to run. To run. Sissy didn't have that option. She was there with Shirley. And the situation came about over the period of time where Sissy became the mom and Shirley became the daughter. Because as Shirley began to drink, Sissy would take control of her. And I think one of the greatest blessings that God has allowed me to be a part of is to see those two gals reverse that relationship in recovery, where Shirley's the mom today and Sissy's the daughter. And I've been allowed to just stand off to the side and watch that happen. And they did it through you people and these 12 steps. Couldn't have done it without it. But things continued to get worse. The loneliness, the confusion, the isolation. It was all there. Not knowing what to do. Wanting to do something so bad and not knowing what to do. And then one night the kids and I went to a ball game. And when we came home, something was different. Shirley was still up. She had been drinking, but she was not drunk. And she told us when we came in that she had called a treatment center and that she was going to do something about her drinking. And I reacted like any good, untreated Al-Anon should. I did not believe her and told her so. How many times had she told me, this is it. I'm changing. There won't be any more. And I thought this was just another one of those feeble attempts. As you see, it was really, really puzzling to me because I could stop. And if I could stop, why couldn't she stop? And I didn't understand that. We went on to bed. The next day, the treatment center called me for some insurance information, and that's when I began to believe that she had made an effort, that she was taking a step. And God was working in our lives at that time. And we didn't realize it. Because God had directed her to a treatment center that believed wholeheartedly in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And folks, that was God working for us because there were some treatment centers around that did not believe in those 12 steps. And God sent us right straight to one. And we took her off up there, and when we got her there, they set me and the kids down and they talked to us about something called Family Week. And they said, a couple of weeks from now, we're going to want you to come to Family Week. We want you to start making plans for it, and we'll write you a letter telling you about it. 3 or 4 days later, I get this letter in the mail, and it says, we want you to come up here, and it gave the dates. We want you to bring both kids. And we want you to come and spend 5 days and live here in the treatment center with us and learn how to live with your alcoholic. And I got the kids together and read them the letter, and I said, we got to go. Up to that point, I had been trying to find ways not to go. But when I got that letter and it said, learn how to live with your alcoholic, I said, we got to go. And so we did. It was in August. The kids were out of school. I had all kind of vacation time coming. And so we went. And 30 minutes after we were there, I was in a stand-up shouting argument with one of the counselors. Because you see, he wanted to talk about me. And I pulled my letter out. And I said, the letter states very plainly, come learn how to live with your alcoholic. And I'm here for you to give me a list of what I can do and what I cannot do, what she's allowed to do. That's what I'm here for. And he smiled at me and he said, well, Bo, he said, that's not what we're going to do this week. We're going to spend some time talking about you. And I said, you lied to me in your letter. And he just laughed and he said, yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. He said, now what would you have done if we had written you a letter saying, Bo, alcoholism is a family disease and you have been affected and you're entitled to treatment and you're entitled to therapy and you're entitled to learn how to get better too. And we want you to come up here and learn about that. What would you have done? And I said, well, I'd have thrown the letter away and I'd have told you, you've got my problem. Fix her and everything will be all right. He said, that's the reason we lied to you, to get you here. And a couple of things happened over that next 5 days that I think I need to share with you, because they call it Family Week and I call it Hell Week. Because it was. But it was the turning point. It was the turning point. Because you see, the first thing that I heard up there that stuck with me was, Shirley's got a disease, Bo, and you didn't cause it. Boy, I had to hear that. I had to hear it because that load of guilt about giving her that drink was getting almost unbearable. And all of a sudden, here were some folks telling me, Bo, you just introduced her to alcohol. You didn't introduce her to alcoholism. And it's only by the grace of God that you don't have that disease too. Because you very easily could have. Because see, it's in my family tree too. And it's only by the grace of God that you don't have it, but your wife does. And you didn't cause it. Then of course they told me I couldn't control it. Well, I could understand that because that's all I've been trying to do. And then, of course, they told me that I couldn't cure it because it was an incurable disease. And then the next thing that they told me was that they were going to have an Al-Anon meeting up there and that I was going. I wasn't told it was available. They told me they were having an Al-Anon meeting and I was going. And on Tuesday night, there was a gal came out there, and I know today what she was doing. She was carrying the message. Carrying the message. She came out there and she held an Al-Anon meeting for all of us that were there in Family Week. And I'm sure that she talked to those other people that were in that room. But I just about, the way I remember it today is every time she said something, she said, Bo. And she told me, she said, Bo, if Shirley is gonna experience any sobriety, when she gets out of here, she's going straight to AA. And if you want to regain your sanity and experience any of this serenity that we're talking about, you're going to go straight to Al-Anon. And she said, that's it. It's cut and dried. There is no other way. And she said, now if you make the decision to go, there's a couple of things that I would like for you to do. So number one, when you go to your meetings, try to be there at least 30 minutes early and plan to stay at least 30 minutes late. Because what you need to hear may not be said during the meeting. It may be said at the fellowship before and after the meeting. And you want to give yourself every opportunity. And the second thing she said, when you get there, you pick you out a winner. And until you can get your feet on the ground and your head screwed back around, you do everything that that winner does. If that winner gets up to go get a cup of coffee, you go get a cup of coffee. Because there probably will be something said at the coffee pot that you need to hear. And of course, I'm beginning to feel good enough now to ask questions. So my question was, well, how am I going to know the winners? And she smiled, and she smiled that winner smile. I know that today. I didn't recognize it that night because she's a winner. And she said, Bo, you won't have any trouble. You will know them. It may not be the one that's speaking the most or talking the most, but it'll be the one that has that smile and that look, the one that feels okay about themselves. The one that's in tune with the God of their understanding. And you'll know them. So I took her advice and decided that I'd try Al-Anon. Because you see, Shirley and I had made a decision that we were going to try this thing called family recovery. They talked to us a lot about family recovery, and we decided that we wanted to experience some of that. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting that Tuesday night in Bessemer, Alabama. And when I walked up to that door, I had already violated the first piece of advice that this gal gave me. Because the meeting started at 8 o'clock and I got there at 2 minutes till. And when I walked up to that door and I looked in, I took a quick head count. And there was 23 women and one other guy. And there was an empty chair beside him. Now the gal was up in the front ready to open this meeting. And I hurried down there and I got that empty chair beside that guy. No time for introductions or anything. They're opening the meeting. And we had that meeting. I can't tell you a whole lot about what happened in that first meeting, except that I felt comfortable. I just felt comfortable. I felt okay. When the meeting was over and we said the Lord's Prayer, I turned around and introduced myself to this guy, and he just looked at me and said, "You must be Bo." Remember that aunt that I told you about? She had put the message out that we were on the way. And I looked at him and I shook hands with him. And I said, "I sure am glad to meet you and know that there's at least one other guy here." And he said, "Boy, I was just hoping you got here tonight so I could meet you." He said, "I'm moving to Phoenix City in the morning." He said, "I wanted to meet you before I left town." God was looking out for this big old boy there. Because you see, I was so sick and I was so confused that it took all 23 of those gals for me. And if Kirvin had still been in town and had a problem, we wouldn't have had time for it. Because I kept them busy. I kept them busy. Now, Shirley went out there in that other room and she got involved in a 12-step program. And she began to work 12 steps in her life and she began to get better. I got involved in the Al-Anon room and I wasn't working any steps, I was just around it. I was just around it. I guess I was going to get it by osmosis. And if the truth is known, I was still there to keep her sober. That's what I was there for. And I got in there and I began to make every classic Al-Anon mistake that you can make. And thank God today those gals would love me enough to let me do those things. Because that's the way I've had to learn. Because you see, I came into this thing in September 1982. And up till today, I've never been able to figure out anything for myself. Everything that I've gotten out of this program has been passed on from you to me. You've given it to me. And thank God you were there. And they allowed me to make these mistakes. I guess the first mistake that I made, I became the classic two-stepper. I wasn't having a whole lot of problem with the first step after Hell Week. They had drilled that into me. And I read in the 12th step about carry the message. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to carry the message. And I got busy carrying the message. And folks, have you ever tried to carry a message that you don't have? Let me tell you, it's tough. It's tough. But you see, the message that I had to carry was that my wife was sober. And I wanted the world to know. Because we had opened up those curtains out there in Hewittown. We had opened up the curtains and we wanted you to come on in now. And that's all the message I had was my life, my wife was sober. But boy, I got busy carrying that message. The second mistake that I made was that I got totally involved in two groups. Don't misunderstand me when I say this to you. I go to several different groups today, but I got a home group. I got a home group. And I know that I'm supposed to show up there on a regular basis. And there was a new group that was starting in Hewittown. My home group's in Bessemer. They're only 5 miles apart. And there was a new group starting in Hewittown, and it was young, and the problem was it didn't have the winners. It didn't have the winners. But they were looking for a leader, and old Bo wanted to be president of Al-Anon anyhow. I'd already decided that. And I got involved in that new group out there. And I almost destroyed that new group. And I almost destroyed me in the meantime. But see, I wasn't working any steps. I didn't have a sponsor. I was sponsoring myself. God's sake, don't try that. And I almost destroyed that young group. And I came home from one of those meetings out there one night, and I was totally miserable because we'd had another big argument about nothing. About nothing. And I came home, and I was upset, and I looked at Shirley, and I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And Shirley was smart enough to tell me, I think you better go back to Bessemer. And you better get back with those winners. And this was 6 months into Al-Anon. And it took me 6 months to get sick enough to try to work this program. 6 months of being around it. You see, I came here well and got sick. And I bet I'm not the only one in this room that fits that. And I went back to Bessemer. I made the decision that I would go back to Bessemer. And let me tell you, something strange happened with that group in Hewittown. When I made the decision to go back to Bessemer, that group took hold and it started growing. And it's one of the strongest, hardest working groups in our area today. It really is. And to show you how people will forgive, a couple of years ago, they invited me to come back and speak at their anniversary. The very guy that almost destroyed the group. But I went back to Bessemer and I grabbed one of those winners. And I asked her to be my sponsor. And she had a momentary lapse of her sanity and agreed. And she said, Bo, I'll agree to sponsor you if you're ready to go to work. And I said, well, friend, I'm ready to go to work. Because see, work meant chairing the meetings, getting the speakers, being up front, okay? And she said, no, that's not what I'm talking about, Bo. She said, I'm talking about going to work on yourself. And I said, well, how do I do that? She said, we got 12 steps to take care of that. And if you're willing to make the commitment to try to take these 12 steps and work them in your life on a daily basis, then I'm willing to make the commitment to take you by the hand and lead you through it. And that's what my sponsor has done for me. That's what she's done. And God knew when he was sending me to Fran. Because you see, there's some things that happen later on in our lives that prepared her to be able to carry me through some very troubled times. And God knew that this in his master plan, he knew what was going to happen. And Fran took me on. Boy, has she had second thoughts about that, but she took me on. And I began to get a little bit better. I began to feel a little better about Bo. And I got to that third step. Really, I got to the fourth step. I was trying to write an inventory and I couldn't get it written. And I went to Fran and I said, Fran, it's not supposed to be that hard. And I'm just having all kind of trouble. And she smiled and she said, Bo, you probably haven't, if you can't get it done, you're getting your steps out of line again. She said, you can't work four till you've worked three. And she said, you probably need to go back. She said, let's go back and spend some time in step three. And it was there that I realized that I had misunderstood step three the way it applies to me in my life. Because you see, I reverted right back to that Southern Baptist church. And I said, gosh, you know, if I turn everything over, God's either going to make me a preacher and I can't preach, or a song director and I can't sing, or he's going to make me a missionary. And I wasn't ready for the church. You see, I wasn't ready to get back involved at the church at that time. And I was confusing the two. And I was trying to work my way through this. And I got up one morning and I looked at Shirley and I said, I don't want to go to work. This was on a Wednesday morning. And I said, I don't want to go to work. She said, well, won't you take some time off? You got all kind of time coming. And I said, I don't want to stay at home. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to get away from Bo. I want to get away from Bo. Almost 7 months into this program and so miserable that I couldn't stand me. And Shirley didn't have an answer for that, of course. And I made the decision that I could be as miserable at work as I could anywhere, and I'd get paid for it. So I got in my truck and I started to work, and it's a 5-minute drive to where I was working at that time. And halfway to work at about 5 minutes late on that Wednesday morning, I pulled my truck over on the side of the road out of traffic. And I sat there and I beat on the steering wheel as I talked to God. And I told him, I said, God, I don't know where you're going to carry us. I don't know what you got in store for this old boy. But I know today that I can't fight it any longer. And wherever it is you're going to take me, whatever you're going to do with me, I'm yours to do it with. And I turned it over. And I'm telling you, if those feelings that I had, that confusion and that anger and that anxiety and that worry and that self-pity and those resentments and that anger that I'd been carrying around inside me, if those feelings could have been water, they would have made a puddle at my feet as I felt them drain out of me. And I had a feeling of peace. And I knew that it was going to be okay. I didn't know what, but I knew it was going to be okay. And I went on to work. And nothing special, nothing spectacular happened during that day at work. Except I remember this. When I got home that afternoon, I was not totally tired. I was not mentally beat. I was not fatigued. I felt okay. And from that day until this moment right now, I can honestly tell you that on a daily basis, to the best of my ability, I have tried to do God's will in my life. Sometimes I do good. Sometimes I don't do good. I'm real quick to jump back in there and take it over. I'm real quick to fire God and hire Bo. The difference today is I know it. I know it, and I can stop and make those changes. I think really and truly, that was the day that I got in Al-Anon, that I got in it. Some of the things that have happened, let me share some of the things that this program has given me since that day. The first thing that I would share with you that this way of life has given me is it's given me freedom. Freedom. Freedom from that fear that I had, freedom from despair, freedom from confusion, freedom from self-pity, freedom from that load of guilt. It's not that these things don't creep back in my life, because they do. They do creep back in my life in the form of living problems. But the freedom I have today is the freedom of choice of whether they stay or not. That freedom of choice. The other thing that this program's given me is it's given me hope. That's our message anyhow, isn't it? Light at the end of the tunnel. It's not as good today as it's going to get. I firmly believe that. But it's a darn sight better than it was. We've come a long way, haven't we? We've come a long way. It's given me a new way of life. A new direction in life that's revealed to me through 12 steps. 12 steps that I try to implement on a daily basis. It's given me back my family life. Because you see, we no longer live in that house out there in Hueytown. Because a house is built by hands. It's made of wood. Bricks. Built by hands. Today we live in a home, and that home is built with love and care and compassion and a spiritual understanding. It's given me back to me. Al-Anon gave me back to me. Because when I got here, I did not know who I was, and I did not know what I was. But when it gave me back to me, it made me responsible to me for me. And the beautiful part about that is that when it made me responsible to me for me, it meant I did not have to be responsible for you any longer. I no longer have to accept responsibility for you. And it's all that I can do to accept the responsibility for me. This program gave me a new concept of God. Because you see, I knew right away that I was not going to be able to make it with that concept that I brought out of my childhood. And I got this concept of God right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of those Al-Anons that suggest that you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I know it's not conference approved for Al-Anons, but I suggest that you read it. If you have a problem with that, you just have a problem. I'm not suggesting that you put Al-Anon literature down in any way. I'm suggesting that you find a little extra time and read the big book. Because you see, in the chapter to the agnostic, it talks about a young man who was a minister's son. Certainly should have had an understanding, a minister's son. And he's having a spiritual experience. And during this spiritual experience, he said he found himself standing in the presence of infinite power and love. Infinite power and love. And that he had stepped from the bridge to the shore. And what he means there is he had stepped from the bridge of reason to the shore of faith. And he was in conscious companionship with his Creator. And that's my conception of God today. Infinite power, infinite love, never ending, that's available for me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The last thing that I would share with you has probably been one of the most important things that this program gave to me. Because you see, life goes on. Life's tragedies go on. And I'd been in this program, I don't know, 5.5 years, going on 6. And we had a tragedy to happen in our life that I hope I never have to experience anything that even comes close to it ever again. As we were at home on a Tuesday night, and the police came to our door and informed us that our 20-year-old son had been killed in an automobile accident. Beautiful, beautiful, wholesome, loving, blonde-headed, blue-eyed 20-year-old young man who had never caused his daddy a minute's trouble. I'd never had to go get this young man out of trouble. He had never caused us any problems. He had spent his life doing for other people. We didn't know about a lot of the things that he had done until after his death. And then this is compounded by the fact that he was killed by a drunk driver. And I immediately forgot everything that you had taught me, everything that you had shared with me, and I got mad. And I got mad at God. And I got mad at everybody around me. But you see, the last thing that this program gave me was it gave me you. It gave me you. And 30 minutes after we found out about it, you were there. AA and Al-Anon was in our home. Physically in our home, you were there. And this sponsor that I talked about was there. And she was there to comfort us through this because 2 years prior to this, she had lost a daughter to suicide. God preparing friends. Take care of both. I believe that today. And I became bitter. Real bitter. I could not understand why God would take this young man who was in the throes of life, who loved people and loved doing for people, how he could take him away. And I began to judge other people and I began to judge their children. And I was questioning God. And the following day, the young man that was to preach Mike's funeral came over and sat down at the house with me, and we were drinking a cup of coffee, and I looked at him. And I said, George, I'm questioning God. And I know that I shouldn't. He's a wise young man. He looked at me and he said, boy, you think you're powerful, don't you? You really think you're powerful, that you're so above being human that God doesn't allow you to question him. Sure, God allows you to question him temporarily. Sure. Because you see, I talked to you about that bridge of reason to the shore of faith. I had got back over on the bridge. I was trying to understand this thing. And there was no way for me to understand it. I was not supposed to understand it at that time. Don't understand it today. And George looked at me and he said, "Bo, here's where we are." And he said, "This is the way I'm going to preach Mike's funeral." He said, "You're faced with one of the greatest tragedies that a parent could ever face. It's different from a mom or a dad. It's different from a spouse. This is your child." And he said, "You got a choice to make." He said, "You can take this tragedy and you can run off in a corner and you can become bitter. Or you can turn it over to God where it belongs and you can grow through it and become better." He said, "Now what do you think you want to do? Do you want to become bitter or do you want to become better?" And I sat there and I looked at him and I said, "Doggone you, you've just summed up Al-Anon. You've just put me right back in my 12 steps." And that really is our choice, isn't it? That's our choice in life. I'm not comfortable with Mike's death today. God, I miss him. I miss him so much. It's almost a year now. I still miss him. And I hope that I don't ever get to the point that I don't miss him. But I know today that God was not punishing me with Mike's death. God was not testing me with Mike's death. God was giving me an opportunity to grow and become stronger and become better. Because you see, what I've come to understand from this thing is that the God that I know today and the God that I serve today loves me so much that out of all the people on the face of this earth, he picked me to be God, to be Mike's daddy. He picked me. And he gave me 20 beautiful, trouble-free years with that young man. And I know today, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Mike is in that heaven that I dream about. I know he's there. And I know that if I am to ever see him again, I got to get real busy and stay busy doing what God would have me do on a daily basis. On a daily basis. So once again, as I close, the last thing that I would share with you that this program gave me was it gave me you. And I know that it doesn't make any difference whether I'm in Baton Rouge or whether I'm in Birmingham or whether, doesn't matter where I am on the face of this earth, that unless I choose, I don't ever have to be alone again. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you, and God bless you.